music from Andrew Eastman from over in England. Forgiveness, the name of his song. We heard from Susan Ashton, No One Knows My Heart. We heard from Taylor Sorensen, Althea, in what was really intended as a Christmas song, but it needs to be heard all year. Love Came Just in Time. Also heard from Tommy Coombs and the Maranatha Singers, Call on the Lord. 14 minutes after the hour, it is Tuesday, and of course that means a chat with the Reverend Dr. John DeLancey from Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, a suburb. Would it be right to call it a suburb of Pittsburgh, John?
That's correct. We're about 10 miles north of downtown Pittsburgh.
Okay, and are there Pirates banners all over town?
Yes. In fact, we're glad that we purchased your Justin Minot guy.
That's right, Justin.
That's right.
Pittsburgh, that's right.
Has he helped you so far?
He went 1-for-2 with a walk the first game, and I think 0-for-2 yesterday with a couple walks, but he started two games.
John's a Philly fan, too, and he's got the box score in his head from the Pirates game. I think that's pretty amazing. John's also an umpire. You had a good season of umpiring?
I did. The summer was a little slow. I was gone so much, but
did
some umpiring and always good to get a game or two in the fall also.
Yeah, well, it is kind of fun. And it's kind of fun settling all those arguments, those disagreements, isn't it? They come out and they throw bases and kick dirt on your feet and stuff?
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
It's just only the knucklehead coaches that you see on TV. But I'm hoping to get actually a couple games again this year at University of Pittsburgh. They have fall ball and it's sort of inter-squad games and low-key and Division One baseball, and it's always a fun experience. I had 3 games last fall.
It's kind of a feeling of power, isn't it, to be an umpire and say you're out of here?
Yeah, I guess so. Safe. All depends on the situation, but you always get the best seat in the house, of course.
Yeah, you do. I've done that for some kids' games. It is fun. You do so many things. You're headed off to Israel again in October, and again in November. You've been there what, April, June, July? When do you ever sit still?
Well, I'm trying to juggle my schedule between pastoral work and leading trips, but that's a great opportunity.
And ultra marathons. So, by the way, yesterday was the anniversary of Pheidippides. Do you know the name?
I do know the name, but I don't recall what he was associated with.
Well, he was the guy that was with the Athenian forces in 490 BC fighting the Persians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Battle of Marathon.
Oh, okay. He's the guy that ran.
He was the guy that ran the distance, the 26 miles or so, and then died. But we found out why he was so exhausted yesterday. It turns out that Pheidippides, just the day, 2 days before, had been asked by the Athenians to run to Sparta, 136 miles away, and get help, military help. And this is over torturous mountains and ups and downs and just barren land. And he ran 136 miles. And it took him, I think it was 36 hours, something like that. And he got to Sparta, and he said, "Send help. Send help." And they said, "No." And so he turned around and ran back 136 miles, and he reports to the Athenian general, and he goes, "They said no." And the Athenian general said, "Put on your armor. We're going to war." So he fought a whole day in heavy armor, swinging swords and stuff, and they won the Battle of Marathon. And then the general says, Go announce the victory. And he ran another 26. That's when he died, after that 26 miles. The guy had been on the road for 3 days straight running. And so there's a story of Pheidippides. So I'm just thinking, you as an ultramarathoner, if you really wanted to do an ultramarathon, John, there's a model for you.
Bar set.
But you'd have to die at the end, which would rather not have happened. So anyway, so you're a busy person, and among the things you do is archaeology. That's yet another area of expertise of yours. And you've sent me a couple photographs that are fascinating. These appear large stoneworks. What are these things?
They are gates attributed to a guy who appears in the Old Testament named Solomon.
Mm-hmm. I know the name.
Yes, a very familiar name in the Hebrew Scriptures. But it's not surprising at archaeological sites to find gates like this. Solomon, as we know from 1 Kings 9, fortified particular cities. They were strategically located cities meant to control the natural route that went past these cities. So if you held the city guarding the route, you certainly held and were in control of everything around it. So,
well, not only that, but what goes in and what goes out. I can see from this one picture, this is the second of the two, that there's nothing there to tell me the scale of this, but these are pretty massive stoneworks. And and the gate, I'm guessing, what, maybe 10, 12 feet wide? The opening?
Yeah, the gate that I sent you as a picture is mm-hmm. one of these Solomonic gates at Gezer. The other one that I sent you was from Megiddo, mm-hmm. Which guarded the whole Jezreel Valley. And then the most northern city that the Bible tells us that Solomon fortified was Hazor or Hazor. Mm-hmm. And that, again, believe it or not, to no surprise, also has a Solomonic gate.
Now, are they similar? I mean, they're made of stone. Were they faced in a decorative way with plaster? Were they different in the day of Solomon?
They probably had a type of capital on them, mm-hmm. facing outward, a little decorative. But these chambers were these gates were actually a six-chamber gate, which was quite common for all of Solomon's gates. All the gates that we find in Israel were laid out in this fashion. They had three chambers on one side and three on the other.
And I should mention that we'll post these photographs with the podcast today so that if you come back later to our audio archives and look up this podcast for today's morning show with John, you'll see these pictures of the gates. It looks to me from this one picture that you can't just go straight in. I mean, this is planned for defensive purposes, isn't it?
It really was. McAllister, actually, the picture that you'll post first from Gezer, McAllister, about 100 years ago, actually excavated only one half of the gate and then stopped there, and it concluded that this was some kind of Maccabean fortress.
Hmm.
But when Bill Deaver and others came after in more recent archaeological work there, they discovered the other side, which really complements and completes the picture for us. So when people would have entered the city, they would have been facing these three chambers or a total of six chambers on both sides, and it would have been quite defensible in terms of, you know, the entrance and the exit to the city.
I'm thinking about the difference in these two pictures, too, and I'm pretty sure I'm looking at the one of Megiddo because they don't have them labeled here, but this is the mm-hmm. one with the greenery, the crops in the background, the green hillsides. That must be north where there's rainfall. The other picture, it looks pretty barren. It looks very deserty.
Well, the first picture is the Ajalon Valley, and mm-hmm. it is Gezer.
It's pretty.
So we're actually looking towards the hill country of Judah.
Okay.
This was, in fact, the area where the sun stood still in the Joshua 10 story, mm-hmm. for instance, the Ajalon or the Ajalon Valley. But in terms of these chambers, it's interesting that there was actually a watering channel, if you will, underneath it. So there was this was made with even drainage in mind, and underneath the gate was probably
so that's the ditch
fortified.
That's ditch through the center that we're looking for. That was for water, for drainage.
Yeah, it okay. probably was. And even mm-hmm. on the left chamber, believe it or not, a cistern was actually found between the first and second chamber, which is interesting and unique to a Solomonic gate. But mm-hmm. the other picture that I sent you actually shows you how deep these chambers were. And of course, if you were defending the city, any gate would have had soldiers positioned most likely on top of it, of course, and probably on all of these three chambers, guards would have been posted to make entrance into the city quite difficult.
Now, this kind of relates to some really ancient history, you know, before New Testament times anyway, when a king, a prince, whatever his title was, really had control over a fortified city. And he would marshal his troops seasonally, spring, summer, and they'd go out and fight and rape and loot and pillage and burn and bring back the treasure to their own city. Mm-hmm. Not unlike what was happening in Europe centuries later. Kind of a feudal society. People go out outside the walls, work the crops, come back in for protection at night. This was a violent society to have this many fortified towns around.
Yeah, every city that was fortified with a wall was certainly defensible, but the weak spot of every city was, believe it or not, the gate structure. The word gate in Hebrew, sha'ar, it's actually mentioned 375 times. So we know that gates were not only places for defense, but they were typical places that were designated as sort of the center of city life in biblical times. So a lot of things happened at the gates, like people paid taxes at the city gates.
I was just going to say these chambers could have served a number of municipal purposes, couldn't they?
They did. So when wartime was not taking place or a siege was not imminent, these chambers would have been used for officials. In fact, the gate at Dan, you can actually see a seat, if you will, where the official would have, or the judge would have sat and settled legal matters there.
Mm-hmm.
We know that prophets, for instance, prophesied and kings ruled in the gate area. Lot sat at this gate at Sodom. Boaz, for instance, established his, I guess you could call it, his legal right to marry Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
That happened at the gate. So
now, well, that's logical, because if there are walls all around your city, the gate is the point of activity. That's where people are passing through in and out all day.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like the internet of the day. I mean, if you were there, you were in touch with what was going on.
Yeah, they were. But when you needed to secure the city with the enemy around it, of course, gates were very important. And one had to make sure that the gate was not the weakest point of the city because of the ability for the enemy, of course, to penetrate through the gate. But gates were usually double-walled doors. They were wooden. Nehemiah gives us that hint in chapter 2. They were often plated with metal. Psalm 107 and I think Isaiah 45 tells us that. They were usually secured with an iron bar or even a wooden bar.
Kind of a crossbar across the back,
mentions. But, you know, some gates actually, the Megiddo gate actually had sort of a dual entrance. One was straight forward, if you will, perpendicular to the walls, but another entrance was sort of on an angle. So if you were an enemy soldier trying to advance through the city, you would not only have been exposing yourself probably on one of either your right or left side to the people positioned on the wall, but once you got into the gate area, well, then you were facing probably six groups of soldiers standing on top of these chambers ready to defend the city that way.
Mm-hmm. How high were these gates?
Probably 12 to 15 feet high. Some of these gates, if you measure the distance between the opening of the gate to the back part of the last chamber, probably about 60 feet or so. So that they were well fortified and well positioned. Of course, the picture will show you that they were always made of stone and very, very strong fortification.
Now, if you look at European history and you see fortified walls and gates to castles, say, which really surrounded a community of buildings and businesses and the royal residence, there were often moats. Do you find moats in the Holy Land at all? Or was there no water, maybe?
We do at Crusader sites.
Mm-hmm. Aha, brought by the Europeans, then.
Exactly, but you know, like Caesarea has a moat there, and I think, well, Nimrod is another Crusader castle up north that does not have a moat, but Balfour is another, I believe it's what it's called in the Jordan Valley. That's the only one that has actually a moat in par with how European cities were built.
Mm-hmm. But this was 2,000 years after David's mm-hmm. time, or 1,900 years.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Gates are fascinating. What else do you find around gates? It must be a great place for archaeologists to find clues of, you know, coins and inscriptions and other archaeological minutiae. What do you find around gates?
Well, at Lachish, for instance, which is an Iron Age gate that played a significant role in trying to defend the Assyrians when they came in the late 8th century BC, that we actually found what is called Lachish letters. They were ostraca that were found right inside the gate that gives us a hint. Now,
these are pottery shards.
Cities.
Yeah, pottery shards with figures inscribed on them. Yeah,
that's right. And it actually tells us that the two last standing cities during the Assyrian invasion was, I'm sorry, during the Babylonian invasion, I'm a century off, were the cities of Lachish and Azekah. And so once in a while, important inscriptions are found at gates that gives us a hint of the type of battle or the type of siege that was taking place there.
Now, the gates, so Jerusalem is famous for its gates, sheep gates and dung gates and fish gates and, you know, all those things. Were those of similar construction?
They were, but the old city today of Jerusalem is, of course, Turkish wall, so gates there played a different role. Sometimes, in fact, you can still see as a part of the gate structure little outcrops from the gate where you could drop oil down or a little slit opening where you could actually easily shoot an arrow out of, you know, one of these slits that were a part of the gate structure, so that you would have, of course, been protected yourself, but you still could have shot out of the gate to the enemy below or at a distance. But gates in every time period of archaeology were very significant, and again, as strong as they were made, they actually were the weak point of every city.
Now, at Giza and some of these other locations, were these mainly military towns? They were there for defense primarily, or were they cities to begin with, villages?
These were fortified cities. Of course, you know, when the text tells us that Solomon fortified these particular cities, one in the south, one in the middle area, and one at the north, that was for strategic reasons, because if you held these cities, you most likely held the natural routes or the area surrounding the city. So here in the context of a Solomonic gate, they were certainly used for controlling the region.
Now, by the time that Solomon built the gates, to the Philistines were pretty well dispensed with, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They were, you know, so from the Gezer down to the five cities of the Philistines, that's just a short, you know, in some instances, maybe 8 or 10 miles away. That's where one of the closest cities of the Philistines were located.
So if they were fortified cities at that stage of history, he must have built these with the Assyrians in mind, or maybe the Egyptians, or any other major power, huh?
Well, Gezer was taken by the Egyptians, if you remember from the text.
And then given back
to Solomon's wife, who was, of course, the Pharaoh's daughter. So the Egyptians even were here in Gezer, but it was Solomon who really refortified, if you will, the city for those strategic reasons.
Interesting. Once again, we'll have these two photographs of gates posted with the podcast a little bit later today at brokenroadradio.com, and you can take a look at them. And of course, you can always do an internet search on your own and search for these gates. But just great information when you get to listen to an archaeologist telling you the significance of these gates and how they were constructed and what's found there. John, always appreciate your presence here on the program, and looking forward to your October trip. That's all full. You got some seats left for the November trip to Israel?
Yeah, this week is the last week to sign up for the November trip. But all the other trips next year are wide open.
Well, it's biblicalisraeltours.com, and of course there's a link on our website at brokenroadradio.com. It'll take you there, and John blogs to his blog site when he's over at Israel. You can learn day to day what they're seeing and what the result is. And yeah, David, David raised his hand.
Just raised my hand.
Yes,
I just
David.
Wanted to see if I
get a word in edgewise here. Yes,
have a chance to get a word. I'm just curious. You know, I see that, you know, the lot of similarities. I've been looking at a lot of different gates around the Megiddo and the Hazor and a number of the other sites. Any idea how this particular construction started? I mean, where did this evolve from? Did somebody, I guess it's too much for me to imagine that somebody just came up with this notion, this double back, this protected around on all sides type gate would be just kind of some genius walked in someday and say, "Hey, I've got a great idea for a gate." I'm thinking that it might have evolved from something. Any idea where that came from?
Well, early bronze gates, for instance, gates that would have been around about 3000 BC, as opposed to Solomon's time period of 1000 BC, they were double chambered gates. Middle bronze gates, for instance, about 600 years or 1000 years after the early bronze, some of those gates are actually four chambered gates. So it seems like there has been a development. So when Solomon comes in 1000 BC, he had the concept down and probably just maximized the usage of a gate. Again, they were places where not only you defended the enemy, but, you know, places where, even like Proverbs 22, it says, "Do not exploit the poor because they are poor, and do not crush the needy in court." Well, literally, that word in Hebrew is "in the gate." So, again, giving us a good description of everything happened around the gate. So maybe this six-chamber gate, in view of Solomon building it and using it, played perhaps more purposes than we really realize.
So sometimes when we see the word court in the Bible, it really refers to the gate of the
temple. Amos 5, you hate the one who reproves in court. Literally, that's a misinterpretation. It really is in Hebrew the word sha'ar, or the gate.
So I'm wondering if these additional chambers then down through the eons really kind of parallel a development in the economy. There could have been multiple gates with merchants. You mentioned the possibility of collecting taxes as you go in or out of the city. And certainly that would be a place for beggars to congregate as well.
Yeah. In fact, every official document probably exchanged hands from one person to the other, probably in the context of the official, you know, governing or ruling or making his proclamation at the city gate, because it was such the prominent location in every city.
Any other gates around that are on the verge of being discovered? Do we know? Are there people looking actively for more of these gates? Because there seems to be a wealth of archaeological information at the gate site.
Well, there was a gate that was found at this new site in the Shvela, the Kayafa site. We've talked about that before. So if you find a gate structure, no doubt you're going to find some walls around the city as well, because that city most likely was fortified in the most maximum way. But that's probably the most recent excavation that's taking place. Where I'm hoping to dig next June, I know they found some clues of a fortified wall, and they excavated in the area where the gate should be. This is a site called Abel Beit Makah up north, and I'm sure next year in the season to come, they will probably begin or continue in this gate area to see and find structures from that ancient
gate. Now, that location has what, one biblical mention? Was it?
It's mentioned a couple times in the context of the invading Assyrians from the north. But I'm anxious to see what is discovered there in the next couple years of excavation.
Reverend Dr. John DeLancey, pastor in Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, a frequent traveler to the Holy Land. And when he goes with people, there's kind of an archaeological emphasis to his tours. And it would be just a wonderful thing to go with you, John. So still a few seats open in November. And then what, quiet through the holidays, or do you go back after November?
March, April.
Okay.
June, and maybe a trip in February with a seminary in California. So we're still trying to put the finishing touches on that trip.
Well, biblicalisraeltours.com is the website. Once again, you can link to them from our website at Broken Road Radio. John, as always, thank you for joining us. It's been a delight. And we learned something, too. John DeLancey. We'll talk to you next week.
See you guys.
Music from Philip Kevren and his orchestra.